Hello, friends, and happy new year. Welcome to Josiah Venture Stories. Gwen Gardner here, and for the month of January, we will be sharing the main talks from our last fall conference. Thank you for joining us for this teaching podcast. Generations change. They are always in motion. Often we are tracking the change, but sometimes change comes abruptly, like an explosion. There have been three major explosions over the last few years: the social media explosion, the COVID explosion, and the family explosion. And how should we respond? We need to be giving young people the teachings of Jesus, the gospel, but we also need to bring them the healing of Jesus. Our annual 2023 fall conference theme was Lifeline, First Responders and the Anxious Generation. We brought in Dr. David Van Dyke, a marriage and family therapist and professor at Wheaton College, to speak and train us all in what it looks like to be like Jesus for people in need. Our goal was to equip youth leaders across the region with practical tools to respond to the ever-increasing mental health issues among the youth in their ministries. Thank you for listening, and please continue to pray that we will be first responders for the anxious generation who are fully present, ask good questions, listen well, and point them to the love of Christ.
I'm hoping we can have fun as well as learn. So I'm going to try to balance that. And the other thing is, I may talk a little fast. Just listen fast. No, I'll work on going a little bit slower and quieter. So one of the things, as we were sitting in silence and listening, we're going to talk about that as a skill later on this morning. One of the things that came to me, and I don't know how it fits in the talk, but I'm just going to share because I listened and I heard, of to love is to voluntarily enter into the potential of suffering. And it's a weird thought, right? We have a God who loves us outrageously, and we have a God who understands suffering. And we live in this space. I think about the birth of my kids. I think about falling in love as a teenager, right? Teenage love is different than birth of the kids. Teenage love is a little bit crazy. We call it, in the States, we call it angsty. Teenage love is hot, it's intense, and it's like then their hearts are broken afterwards. And then it's just like, my life is over. Just, I don't want to live anymore. Have you had those conversations with the teenagers? Yeah. And it's that I love, and in stepping into that space of love, I'm stepping into the possibility of hurt. I'm stepping into the possibility of loss. And so we live in this space of, if we do enter into the outrageous love of God, we're also entering into the space of suffering and hurt. And it's not just suffering because of the bombs, the slings, the arrows, the brokenness, but there's something about suffering that's purposeful pain. And so today, as we take a hike metaphorically, right, we're not going to go exercise. You can see exercising. We're not going to do that. We're going to have a metaphorical hike. And we're going to explore, what do we need on these hikes? What do we need in terms of skill set? The first thing that we need is, if I'm going mountain climbing, if I'm going to go on a hike, I want to go with someone that's already gone on the hike. Can you imagine going with a Sherpa it's like, I don't know, I haven't done this before, but let's give it a shot. That's not the person you want to hike with. You want to hike with someone that's gone before. When I lived in Eger in Hungary, we went on hikes, and it was fascinating because we had no idea of the terrain, but the Hungarians did this thing of, they painted things on trees. It was fascinating to me. Vandalism, right? There's just this tag. We call it tagging. The youth tag things, and it looked like someone was tagging trees, and we were confused. And then we started to figure out, oh, like the blue square, we just follow that, and that's a trail. But it took us a while to fit. We're slow. The Van Dykes are slow. It took us a while to figure that out. But someone had gone before and left markers that guided us, even though we'd never been on the trail before. Someone had gone there and done that already. So hopefully today, if you haven't been on the trail of how to listen well, how to be present, how to ask curious questions, this is going to be your first time on the trail. That's great. I've been there for 24 years. So hopefully, you know, and I do have a mischievous side, so I might get you lost a little bit, but then I will come back and get you. All right. So we might leave you at different spots. I'll come back and get you. So youth ministry, youth ministers as first responders. This is where we're getting into the hike metaphor. You are going to come alongside if your youth are walking the way with you and you're doing discipleship, you're doing equip. I'm trying to remember edge. No, what are all the acronyms? So there's, what's the sports one? Edge. So you're doing edge, you're doing fusion. But you're doing these ministries and you're focused on the ministries, and then a kid falls off the rails or a team member falls off the rails. What do you do? Well, we have the ministry. We have to keep the production going, and you set them aside and you hope they'll be okay and you keep doing ministry. Well, I hope not. I hope you can do two things at once: of care for them, know how to stabilize them, getting them into a space where they're safe, where they're at least able to function, and then finding the resources for them. That's what we're going to be doing today. And so as a youth minister, you have two things to focus on when you're a first responder: autonomy and responsibility. Autonomy is similar to agency. Like, you are on your own. You are going to be out there working on your own with the youth, and you got to figure it out. Right? Just like on the trail. My son is out on the trail and someone breaks a leg. They can't call 112. Is that right? 911 in the States. Depends on the country. Three numbers. That's usually the emergency numbers. And someone comes. You're out on the trail. You can't do that. You have to be able to do that. And so you have the autonomy that you are out there doing ministry. There might not be the resources and you're needing to do something. And then you have the responsibility. You have the responsibility to provide spiritual development, spiritual care, sharing the gospel. Dave talked about this well last night, that it's sharing the gospel, sharing the way of Jesus. We're on the way. It really is a hike, right? The early Christian church talked about our faith as the way, that we're on a process, we're on a journey. And as you're on this journey, you're to provide emotional, but then we saw in Matthew 9 and Matthew 10, you're also responsible for providing emotional, relational, mental health support. The full body, like all of us matters. I think that we have that Gnostic tendency, right? We love the life of the mind and thinking. And so we have a spiritual life a lot of times that's just our mind, but our bodies, our emotions, our relationships, our thoughts, all are important in terms of being redeemed and being reconciled with God. And so you have a responsibility to live in that space. So today we're going to train you in hope, or this couple of days, we're going to train you in three ways. And the first way, you're already doing really well. And that's where you're loving people, teaching them how to love Jesus and follow his way. Next, it's about identifying. How do you know a teen is in crisis? You're going to be able to identify the crises that come. And we're going to focus tomorrow on anxiety, depression, and suicidality and self-harm. And so you'll be able to identify, you'll be able to triage. Triage means make an assessment and provide the necessary care. We're going to give you the skills for that care. The skills are going to be being present. These aren't like fancy things. It's being present. It's a pretty straightforward thing, hard to do. Listening. Everybody thinks they listen until we start having this talk, and then you're going to have weird, uncomfortable lunchtime conversations because you're like, oh, that person's not listening. Also be gentle and gracious with each other as you practice these skills, right? No, like, you're a horrible listener. That's not the kind of feedback that you want to give. Be present, maybe have a conversation, and then another time gently say, that was really hard. I really didn't feel heard by you. Which is different than saying you are, right? Talking about your experience with the situation is a good way of giving feedback. Saying you are a bad listener is one, it's about who they are as a person, not great feedback. You are this. We talk about that as an ontic kind of statement. It's the essence of who the person is. You're a jerk. You're unkind. You're horrible. We tend to say these things. You're crazy. And probably a better thing is when you do that, it's really difficult. We're behavior focused. That what you did there was not okay. That's different than you're not okay. And this was hard for me as a parent, because I have three boys and a girl, and I would often say, boy, what's wrong with you, right? That's a horrible statement. It's a horrible statement, because implicit in that, underneath that is, you're broken in a very special way, and it's who you are that's broken. My wife would go, do you really mean that? And I'm like, no, but yes. And it's just like, she's like, well, why don't you focus on the behavior of like what you're doing right there? Not okay. That's a bad life choice. You need to be doing something different. But that kind of feedback is really important when we think about an anxious generation, because I think a lot of times in culture, in the US, here in Central and Eastern Europe, we make statements about personhood when we're giving feedback, when it's really about the behavior and our experience in behavior. And we do that in organizations too. And it's just the way that we've kind of slid in of, it's easier to say you're this versus what you did. It's a longer statement. What you did hurt my feelings. What you did wasn't okay. What you did isn't biblical versus you're unbiblical. You're horrible. It's just so much shorter, at least in English. Maybe in Hungarian, it's a little bit longer. And then the most important thing is know when to refer to professionals. Know when and where to, like, maybe it's a pastoral staff member that specializes in counseling. Maybe it's a medical professional, your primary care physician. Maybe you have resources in terms of counselors that can be helpful. So one of the most important skills that aren't on the list of what I plan to talk to is this thing that works in parenting and it works in child development. I'm curious, how many people have heard of Eric Erickson? Just show of hands. All right. Oh, good. Eric Erickson is a child developmentalist and did a lot of cross-cultural work. And he talks about the eight stages of personhood, trust versus mistrust, autonomy versus shame and doubt, industry versus inferiority. There's eight stages. And everybody memorizes those eight stages. And those eight stages are not the important thing. Professors that taught you psychology, if they only taught you the stages, they were horrible, right? No, they made a bad choice in how they taught. Look at how, right? But see how easy it is to go to the ontic statement versus the behavioral statement? So these professors miss the driving force underneath. And there's three things that you need to know. I guess we do it this way in Europe. Three things that you need to know. What is the need? What is the rule? And how do we meet the need within the rule? Erickson's theory of trust versus mistrust, all those things are what the needs are in general for children, adolescents, adults. When we would parent, there's three types of parents. There's the rule-based parent. And for some reason, this tends to be in the Christian church a lot. Stop it. Don't. Knock it off. Don't make me stop this car. Right? It's all rule-based. Like, no, 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 don't. And we set the rules all the time, setting the rules. Here's the rules. There's another type of parenting that is need-based parenting. Just, you know, you go to the grocery store, the kid's crying, so you just keep on putting grapes in their mouth and trying to figure out what they need to stop crying. I did that one time. I just weighed the child before we went into the grocery store, fed him grapes, and then weighed him after and paid the differential in weight of grapes. Good. Okay, good. Sometimes my humor doesn't translate. So we have rule-based parents focused on the no, don't, stop. You can't do that. You shouldn't do that. We have the need-based parents that just let the children have whatever they want, free range, wandering all over the place. Both of those are problematic. As we think about working with teenagers, this is really important. Is your youth ministry a rule-based youth ministry that you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this? Is it a needs-based ministry? We're just going to have fun. Doesn't matter. It's because it's important for us to all connect and let the kids do whatever they want. Healthy development. healthy youth ministry navigating these things for our adolescents, which will reduce the experience of anxiety for them, is to help them identify themselves what the need is. So helping them know what the rule is, and then helping them meet the need within the rule. So this is the best example I can have, because I think most families talk about, it's not okay to be angry. Don't be angry. And it's usually, don't yell, don't scream, don't kick your sibling, don't pick her nose or pull her hair, or whatever it is of like, don't be angry. So, okay, that expression of anger, not okay. That's a rule. You screaming, not okay in our family. But then I would ask the parents, but that person is angry, so what's an okay way of being angry? I'd like you to turn to your neighbor and share in your family, what were the positive messages about anger expression? The point being, we usually get messages about what not to do, and we don't get the identification of like, anger is a legitimate feeling. It's a legitimate need. We see Jesus getting angry, mostly with the religious leaders that are a little bit more rule-based. And so anger's okay. What's the okay way of expressing it within our family rules, our societal rules, our cultural norms, and our religious beliefs? And then healthy development is, I help the adolescent identify what's underneath that. So they're anxious about something. Maybe it's about social, but maybe it's not about social, but what's underneath that is about being rejected, or the fear of being rejected, or not feeling loved. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to be curious about that with them. What's the need? And then what are okay ways to get that need met? And we have the rules, but that bridge, right? You can see how powerful those three things are. If you get nothing this weekend other than that, or week, I don't know what day it is. If nothing except for those three things, that can guide your ministry, that can guide you on the trail and caring for adolescents and for your team members really well of setting limits, definitely. Identifying the needs, maybe not our skill set, we have to work on that. And then either problem solving together or with adolescents, facilitating them, finding a solution that's meeting the need within the rules. And I love that idea, especially with adolescents, of helping them figure out, okay, what's a behavior that would be helpful that meets the rules, but also meets the need. You're equipping them to kind of think critically within their faith, within their cultural domain, to have a pro-social, a positive response. That all of a sudden, right? We feel it in our bodies. Even talking about this, a lot of times when I teach this, people are like, oh yes, and there's a little bit of a relaxation because it feels hopeful that we can have guidelines, that moral guidelines, faith guidelines, cultural guidelines, and not compromise on them. And realize we have legitimate feelings, needs, and finding creative ways to get those met that are righteous and that fit our culture. And that aren't, for us, sometimes it feels like, as a therapist, people want me to fix things. They want me to provide, what's the answer? There's the rule, here's the need, you solve it. And I'm like, there are so many variables, I don't know what's going to work for you, but I can be with you, facilitating, fostering, encouraging this conversation of your creativity is much bigger than mine. Your ability to figure out what fits within our faith in terms of a practice based on a legitimate need. So our assessment when we're working with adolescents is going to be, what's the need? When they're feeling anxious, when they're feeling depressed, when they're cutting. Dave had conversations with youth from three different cultures, and there was some uniformed responses of what the needs were, and that they were doing self-destructive behavior. That falls in the not okay area. So then when you have such pain inside that you don't even know how to access it and how to feel it, feeling is pain. So the physical pain is a release. It does have a function, right? It has a neurological function of that pain gives me a dopamine hit, which is an antidepressant neurologically. So yes, the pain doesn't make sense. Don't harm yourself. and yet it's meeting a need. So how do we find a different way? Not cutting, how do we find different ways? There can be other pain if we can't get rid of the pain right away, and it's like David talked about a rubber band, right? Here's a little bit of pain that's not self-destructive. It's not the end result, but it's a step towards of like, I still need the pain, but maybe I can do a pain without it being harmful, destructive. And it's a step in the process. It's a triage that then you refer to a professional to deal with. So we need to make an assessment, and the assessment needs to be on what is the youth's need? What are the rules that we work by? What are the cultural rules for them? What are the faith rules for us and the family rules? And how do we meet that need creatively within that? So I'd like you to take a few minutes together and share with your neighbor the needs you're seeing that are beyond your ability or training with the youth or your JV team members. We're gonna come back together. I want you to be able to think about these needs. So the needs that are beyond your capability, beyond your experience, beyond your training, I want you to think about those needs as we continue to think about the skills that applying what we're learning to those needs that you've identified, because we're going to talk about skill sets to hopefully help you think about how do I bridge the gap of, I don't know what to do. Here are the legitimate needs. What can I do within my faith, within my professional limitations, to meet, at least stop the bleeding, for our youth. So triage, how many people have heard the term triage before? All right. Oh, lots of people. Good. So we're going to do triage. You're not going to be therapists, but you're going to be first responders that can do triage. And triage is someone comes into the emergency room and you have to make an assessment of what needs to be taken care of first. So triage is what's to be taken care of first. So you're going to do this assessment. You're going to take care of that. And then you're going to determine what level of care do they need going forward? Can you just kind of continue on the hike? Can you continue on your ministry with this youth? Or do you need to seek more skilled laborers in terms of a clinician, a pastor that has specialization in what the youth's need is? We're going to talk about pastors referring to clinicians, questions to consider. I wrote these to help guide you of questions you need to ask of yourself, of the adolescent's caregiver, if they have a caregiver, a parent, a mentor, some kind of adult figure in their life that's also partly responsible for them, and then questions to ask of a therapist that you might be referring to. These questions, when referring someone to seek professional counseling, pastors may want to ask the following questions of individuals involved, their self, the adolescents, their parents, and therapists. The key to this is if you say yes, you probably should refer. So this is a pretty 0-1 kind of idea. Do I have someone that I can consult with on this situation? If you have no, I don't have someone I can consult to, you probably want to refer. So if like, I don't know who to talk to this about. I'm the only person in the country right now in our team that is dealing with this, and I don't have anybody else to deal with. I need to refer out. Because I'm not getting the supervision or the mentoring I need. How much time am I willing to devote to this person? And this isn't a value statement, right? Sometimes people feel guilty of like, I should put more time down. If your ministry, you're caring for hundreds of kids and one is having a crisis, you may not have time to do the care that's needed. You need to refer them out. You need to have enough time to find the resource for them because you don't have that space in your ministry. It's not a shame thing, right? So a lot of times this question, people feel an internal sense of, I should have the time to do that, or I should make the time to do that. It might not fall within your gifting, your job description, your moment. And it feels like we're not being nice as Christian workers. Nice is not in the Bible, by the way. I have to tell my grad students this all the time. They're like, well, we have to do this Christian niceness. I'm like, well, there's no nice in the Bible. There's kindness, and kindness sometimes is doing the hard thing. I love you enough to say the hard thing, or I love you enough to refer you out, which might not feel nice, but is definitely kind and caretaking for our youth. But we get this sense of shame, like I should be able to do everything all the time, especially when we're out on mission, right? Of like, I have to be back to that autonomy and responsibility. I'm on my own and I'm responsible for all of this. And so then we try to do everything. And then we end up seeing you in therapy because you're burned out, you're exhausted. There's no space for your family. There's no space for your kids. There's no space for your friend. There's no space for your quiet time because you're doing ministry and you're pouring into this. So this question is really important. It's a balance question of, do you have the time? Not like you should have the time. Do you have the time? If you don't, refer out. That's fine. I stopped a large part of my clinical practice because I want to do what I think this conference wants to do and what you all want to do is be force multipliers. I want to train the 400 of you that you can enter into your youth's lives, you can enter into other ministers' lives, and there's a ripple effect, which is much more than my ability to work with one person at one time for an hour each day, and I can help 15 people, right? But there's people that need to do that as well. Do you know your calling? Do you know your lane? Do you know what you're needed to do and when you need to refer out? And this is really important because I think we tend to take on more than we should and we get ourselves in trouble because we're trying to be nice and we're trying to work from a position of, well, I should be able to do all of this. We should all over ourselves all the time. I should do this. I should do this. I should do this. And we get ourselves in trouble. So you get the idea of you go through these questions. Am I struggling with anxiety, depression, failure, fear, anger? I tell my students, if you haven't worked through your stuff in a certain area, you probably shouldn't be working with someone else on that. You need to, it's kind of like on the airplane when the thing we tune out from the flight attendants all the time of put the mask on yourself first and then help others. It's that you need the oxygen, you need the ability to function before you can help others. Because the tendency is I'm going to try to take care of the younger ones around me and then I pass out and we all die. Right? And I see that in ministry. You all are amazing, loving, compassionate people who give. And yet there's not the self-care that's modeling. So you're giving in a sacrificial way, beautiful. But is that what you want to model to the people you're loving that they do exactly? We say, do what I say, not what I do. We want to model, we want to embody what we're saying, what we're doing, what we're teaching. So if we're going to come into adolescents' lives and deal with anxiety, deal with anger, deal with pain, deal with depression, deal with suicidal feelings, deal with self-harm, deal with pain that we can't access, but we know is there and we try to find other ways, whether it's affair, workaholism, right? Working all the time, finding other escapes. We don't want to model that. We need to take care of ourselves and others. Love others as you love yourself. I had a supervisor once say, you would have no friends if you treated them the way you treated yourself. Ouch. It was true, right? It was true, but it's hard to hear because it sounds selfish. It sounds like it's me-centric. It's not. It's I'm as valuable as you are, and you're as valuable as me. How do we treat ourselves and each other equally as image bearers of the triune God? How do we treat each other equal and valued? And so we're modeling. And we see that in scripture, Jesus modeling for the disciples, whether it's having ministry, feeding the 5,000 and needing to have a break. Jesus had breaks. We're going to talk about that. Breaks from ministry. He not only taught us the way, he modeled it for us. How are we doing that? We need to think about that because we may be limited and need to refer out even as a first responder. If you and your adolescent broke your leg on the trail, you probably should take care of your leg first before you're able to help them. That's the metaphor. Am I uncomfortable with this person's issue or this person in general? Why? Probably should refer out. Am I dealing with my own issues on the matter that's being presented? I should refer out. Do I find myself being attracted, angry, disconnected at, towards, from this person, I probably should refer out. You're getting the sense, right? A lot of times you should probably refer out to professionals who have had years and years of going through this. Now, all that's to be said, if you have nobody to refer out to, then you kind of have to figure it out. It's not ideal, but if there's nobody else around, then you have to, as a wounded healer, need to figure it out. But hopefully, as I look at the app with all the resources per country, there's people there for you. It's growing more than it was 10 years ago, that there's Christian mental health professionals in your country or near your country that you can collaborate with. The best way to refer out is to have a conversation with those professionals, not in a crisis moment when you have to refer, but hey, let's go get coffee, or let's go get tea, or can we have a Zoom call? And build a relationship with them that then you can reach out to them for advice or for referral. The beautiful thing, and I won't say this much, but the beautiful thing about COVID, right? No sentence ever starts that way. The beautiful thing about COVID is that all of a sudden we've learned to use technology in ministry and in mental health in new ways that increase accessibility. That there's now a developing field in the States where some of my students that are working at our clinic can do marital work all around the world. So if there's a couple in crisis, Wheaton College's Marriage and Family Therapy Clinic can be helpful now, where years before it'd be like, oh, you got to come to the program and then go back to your country and get accredited by the NHS. And then that's how we can be helpful. Very distant help. With telehealth, outside of the time difference, there's resources at Wheaton for you that you can contact me, contact my staff. It's developing that relationship. It's realizing there's other resources and how do I network and develop them. Things to ask the adolescent and parent. Is this an individual issue? Is this something I need to deal with just with the child? Or is this a relational issue? When I was doing youth ministry in the early and mid 90s, long time ago, there was a tendency of parents and youth ministry people of the adolescents went to the youth ministry people and the parents were like, and felt like they didn't have to deal with it anymore. And we would do our ministry with the kids and we never talked to the parents because they were annoying and intruded and had ideas of what we should be doing. And so we're like, yeah, we got it. And there was a disconnect between youth ministry and parents. I'm hoping that's changed in the last 30 years. If it hasn't, this is going to be the start of something new. Of how do you think of your youth ministry as a family ministry? How do you think about working with youth in Fusion and in Edge and the activities as a family event? Because they're a resource for you. You may hear from the adolescents, my parents are horrible. What are the parents' needs? What are the boundaries in terms of rules of how they're relating? How can we help them bridge whatever their needs are within the rules in parenting their children? So parents are a resource for us. When we think about the crisis, anxiety, depression, suicidality, how are we involving the parents? I would say a lot of the crises that we're seeing are needing to kind of bridge this separation between teenagers and authority, teenagers and parents, teenagers and mentors, that we want to be bridging that. We want to ask on a scale of 1 to 10, how are you feeling, right? I know you all love when you go to the physician, they're, what's the pain on a scale of 1 to 10? 10, otherwise I wouldn't be in the doctor's office, right? Or you're my children who have no sense of pain and everything's a 2 and they have like an abscessed tooth that they can't chew and they still are telling the doctor 2 and they look in the mouth and they're like, you're a bad parent because this child can't chew. And it's like, he said he was a 2 on a scale of 1 to 10. So the scaling is part, but it's not the only thing. You also have to observe what's going on for the youth. So they may report, under-report or over-report. Reporting is just one part of it. The other part is we have to engage with them and assess also, are they minimizing? Are they kind of going over the top? How much care is needed here in the moment? Are they safe? Involving parents is a risk if they're not safe. So having doing a safety assessment. How are things at home? When your parents get mad, what happens? I want to make sure that there's safety before I step into a situation that I don't know what's going on. So you need to think about safety. And oftentimes, if you're saying they aren't safe, they have a high score, you're going to need to refer. So default mode is, if you don't know if you should refer or not, what should you do? Okay, let's try that again. If you don't know if you should refer or not, what should you do? Refer. Good. And then, the most important part is the clinician that you're referring to competent? So that's the last 10 or 8 questions. Are they open to Christianity? Because you may not find a Christian mental health professional. Mental health professionals can be helpful whether they're Christians or not. There's a lot of similar training, but the question is, are they open to faith as a part of the conversation? I've seen some amazing mental health professionals that don't have a faith and aren't necessarily interested in a faith, but have been really helpful with some of their Christian clients because they're open to where the person's coming from and entering in and supporting them. So we need to think about that of, are they open to Christianity? Are they open to the gospel as part of the process? If they're not, I wouldn't refer them to them, but they don't have to be a Christian mental health professional to be a referral source. I would want them to be open to the gospel in the life of the person that I'm referring to, because that's central to our ministry, that's central to the youth, and it should be central to the care. So that's important. Do they offer information showing an openness? Are they willing to interact, collaborate with pastor? So if the adolescent and family will sign a release, will the therapist involve spiritual leaders in the therapy process? If they say no, I wouldn't refer to them. So this is to help you think about, you may not have a Christian mental health professional, but if there's a mental health professional that is open, that's going to involve the pastoral team, that'll involve you if the client gives a release of information, that will be someone that could be on your referral list. Have they been helpful before? Do they know somebody that you know that it's been safe, right? So does your pastor know them? Does other community members work with them and have felt helped and valued in terms of their faith? That's really important. Because we don't want the therapy process to replace the gospel. And I think that's often the fear, that therapy becomes a religion in and of itself. Therapy becomes the healing process that's not centered on Christ. And there can be good relational science that's amoral. It's not sinful. It's just not connected to any sense of morality. It may be helpful if it's willing to embrace our faith, right? We want to see the theory of change through the lens of the gospel. Are they congruent or not? If they're not, I'm not going to go to that provider. If they are, I will make a referral to that provider. Does that make sense? It expands our resources a little bit, but it also is providing safety because we don't want false teachings. We don't want the solutions to be prescriptive that are outside the rules. We have needs. We want it to be within the rules of our faith. The truth of the gospel, the life of Jesus, that what the solutions are congruent with that. A provider needs to be appreciative of that, even if that's not where they're coming from in terms of their faith at the moment. Are they certified? And then is it in person via telehealth? So these are questions to ask as you're thinking about referring. So as you're on the trail, a crisis happens, it's beyond you. How do you find the person you need? How do you know what level of care they need? These are some questions to help guide you. All right, we're gonna get into our next area. A lot of these skills are personal for me. When I was 14, I needed a first responder in my life. So when I was 14 years old, my 12-year-old sister died in an accidental electrocution. And so I had an event that shook my world, shook my faith. My pastoral staff, they thought what was helpful for a 14-year-old to hear right after the funeral is everything works for good to those who call upon the Lord. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what happened. And I did not respond well. I may have said a few things that aren't holy and honoring of the authority of my pastor, but it was a dumb thing for him to say. It's true, right? It's true. Timing was horrible. And I would say probably never is there a good time to tell anyone grieving that statement. It's true. Like looking back 40 years now, I can see how a lot of amazing things that have come in terms of who I am and my ministry from that pain. It was purposeful pain that God used for good, but it wasn't caused by God as good. And that was what I heard. And you remember Dave's slides of men and women or the teenage girls being higher on anxiety than the boys? There's a reason for that. And the reason is girls tend to internalize and boys tend to externalize. So internalization and externalize. Internal is I stuff everything in and I have emotional, I'm anxious, I'm depressed, take it out on myself. Externalize is I take it out on others. Violence, drinking, right? Behavioral problems. And if we would have had up there anxiety for teenage girls and behavioral problems for teenage boys, the graphs would look identical. So the internal experience is the same. The expression is very different. And for girls, it's going to lean more internal. It's an overgeneralization, so you can't say all girls are that way, but that's why the graph looked the way it did, that boys were lower on anxiety. They're still feeling what we call dysregulated, which is the overall term for anxious, depressed, not feeling right in our bodies and our emotions, dysregulated. They both, male and female teenagers, were feeling dysregulated to a large degree, even more now than 10 years ago. But it's going to be expressed different. Girls, it's going to be internalized. So even thinking about objectifying, rather than seeing a person as a person, but objectifying looks different, male and female. Girl objectification tends to be body image issues, tends to be eating disorder, tends to take out on myself because I don't match up to what I see out here. Boys, it tends to be objectifying more in terms of pornography and seeing women as objects rather than as human beings and acting out on that. So again, the same kind of idea, objectification, dysregulation, it's going to be expressed differently, but the need, getting back to identifying the need, identifying the rule and balancing, the needs are very similar, but they look really different in terms of behavior and emotional experience. So I was a 14-year-old boy dealing with loss. Guess what I chose to do with my dysregulation? No one wants to guess. I acted out. I was a delinquent. I also acted out in pro-social ways in terms of good grades, captain of sports teams, performance, right? It's still external. I did a lot of externalization to deal with the internal pain that was going on and really didn't let anyone close. After the pastor said that, I was like, forget church, forget my parents are grieving, forget them, and I'll just deal with it on my own. And I stuffed it down and I took it out on others. And I played violence, like American football. That was the way I let out. I found a pro-social way of causing physical pain. To others. I don't like pain myself, but causing others pain, that's great. I found a pro-social way of doing it as a therapist. I know right where the owies are and I poke for the good of the other, but it's a pro-social way of this kind of coping strategy. Good. Some people are laughing. Others are like, oh, I'm not going to refer to him. So I had this experience. Remarkably, my sister died. We had the funeral. And then I told my parents, 14-year-old, telling my parents, I'm going to Bible camp. Like, I'm out of here. So again, I escaped, but I escaped to Bible camp. I also rebelled. My church was worried about what college I would go to, and I rebelled by going to Wheaton College. So I don't think I understand what rebellion is. But I tried to rebel. I just did it in weird ways. So I go to Bear Lake Bible Camp, and I experience a person that graduated from Wheaton College. He was a high school counselor that was a football coach, and then became a mental health counselor, and then entered into ministry and ran this Bible camp. And I was struggling. I'm pretty sure my parents said, "Hey, Bob, look after him. Check out, make sure he's doing okay." So I remember Bob still, I don't remember a lot of things, but I remember Bob sitting on a rock at Bear Lake Bible Camp with me, and I would just cry and he just sat there. And that relationship of being present was powerful. He didn't say, "God will work good for this," right? And oftentimes when we say kind of positive things to people suffering, we're trying to navigate our own discomfort. It's our own anxiety that we're trying to solve by solving the other's situation. Bob just sat there for days with me crying, not like stayed on the rock all for days. We ate and played sports, but he sat on the rock with me. And that relationship continues. So he showed up in the suffering. He still shows up. So this was from February this year. I got this text. And it shows, to me, it shows that consistent showing up. And this is over 40 years now. I got this text from Bob. It was on February 13th on Facebook Messenger, if that matters. "Praying for you and many Christian ministry leadership friends this morning. King Uzziah's story has been on my heart lately. As long as he sought the Lord, God gave him success. But when he became powerful, he forgot the Lord his God. Keep seeking the Lord with all you have, and know a guy in Jones, Michigan," that's where the camp is "standing with you. A prayer of love, direction, thankfulness, and wisdom went up for David Van Dyke and his family at 11:16 a.m. This was the message he sent. Haven't heard from him since. But he keeps showing up of like, "I'm thinking about you." Have you ever said, "I'll pray for you," right? Well, have you? Maybe sometimes. Bob taught me this discipline. Rather than telling someone I'm going to pray for them, show up by a text and say, "You know what? Thinking about you, said this prayer for you at 11 a.m. this morning." It's showing up. It doesn't solve anything for me in the moment, but I'm not alone. Think about with that your youth ministry. When they're suffering, how do you show up? How do you bear witness to the pain? How do you sit in the pain with them? We have a story of this in Matthew. So Matthew 26 is a beautiful chapter. It's so full, and it makes me tired even thinking about what the disciples were going through, because it started with Jesus anointing at Bethany, and then it goes into the Last Supper. And the Passover Supper was a long process. Lots of food, lots of ritual, ending in song. And we see that happening. So it's probably later in the evening. And then Jesus predicts his death and connects the Passover to what's going to happen, him fulfilling his ministry as the Messiah, dying and rising again for us. And then we have them singing, and then they go off to the Mount of Olives. So just outside the gate, they're at the Mount of Olives, and it's all 13 of them or 12 of them. And Peter's like, "I'm never going to deny you." And all the other, "Yeah, we die for you," right? So there's this kind of emotional connection, camp kind of ministry type of thing, mountain high, right? Campfire at the end. You have that in your ministry. It's the high emotional moment. They've had a long day, high emotional moment. And Jesus then says, "Well, all right, guys, you're gonna deny me, Peter. You're not going to be with me." And then he says, "Peter, James, John's, come on to Gethsemane with me." And so then Jesus went with them to the olive grove called Gethsemane. And he said to James, Peter, and John, "Come with me because I am anguished and distressed." He told them, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death. Stay here and watch with me. Stay here and keep watch with me." Now, there was nothing for them to do but bear witness to Christ's suffering, his prayerful, painful conversation with the Father about what was coming. He was anguished. He was grieved. And he said, I want you to be part of this. He invited the disciples, his three closest. It wasn't all of them. It was his tight group, his closest friends. Be with me. That's all you have one job. Just bear witness. What happens? He went a little farther, bowed with his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it's possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine. Then he returned back to the disciples and found them really kind of supportive, watching, bearing witness. No, they were sleeping. Maybe they were jet lagged. They were definitely tired from a long Passover meal, an emotional high about Jesus explaining his ministry, time of singing. They were exhausted and they couldn't keep their eyes open. There was a legitimate need. They were tired and they fell asleep. And Jesus, I don't think in my reading of this, I don't think it was a shaming. I think it was an emotional bit of like, come on, please stay with me again. He returned to the disciples and found them asleep. And he said to Peter, couldn't you watch with me even 1 hour? Keep watch and pray so that you will not give in to temptation. For the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Then Jesus left them a second time. And he prayed, Father, if this cup cannot be taken away unless I drink it, your will be done. And when he returned to them again, he found them sleeping. For they couldn't keep their eyes open. So yes, they wanted to be with him and they couldn't. They wanted to be there with Jesus. They loved him. They wanted to be present and bear witness and they couldn't and they fell asleep. And Jesus acknowledged that, like your spirit is willing, but your body's weak. And he still invited them in and he did it a third time. Although this time he didn't wake them up. He went back, they were asleep. They couldn't keep their eyes open. So then he went and prayed a third time. So the first time waked them up. Stay with me, realizing they couldn't. Second time, he went back. And then when he came back, go ahead and sleep, have your rest. But look, now we got to get on to the business at hand. Here come the soldiers. It's time to move on to the next part. Jesus wanted us to see the need, the importance of bearing witness, of entering into people's suffering with them. And it's not easy. It's hard to sit quietly with someone that's sobbing that their three-year-old has just died, and just sit there with them, not say anything that's positive, not say anything, and just bear witness. There's something powerful about that for us as image bearers of the triune God, that Jesus invited his disciples to bear witness. I think we're invited as youth ministers, as one of the first response to bear witness to our teen's suffering. It doesn't take it away. It doesn't do anything with it, but it communicates, I'm spending time with you. Yes, I'm strong enough to tolerate entering in your pain with you. There's something important about that. But for me to do that with you, to just sit and let you suffer and bear witness is hard for me. I'm sure it's hard for you. You want it to go away. I don't know about your, I think this is a cultural difference, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in the US, we do everything we can to avoid pain. I mean, we are super medicated, like super, it's life by good pharmacology. We are super medicated. We don't want to feel. And we're medicated by the horrible TV shows that we have in terms of reality TV. It's great medication. It's someone else's suffering, and I can enjoy that, and it helps me not have to sit with my own pain. We avoid pain at any cost. Is that similar for you all? Different? Similar? Yeah. We organize our life to avoid pain. We organize our life to avoid suffering, to feel good, not feel bad. And then this task that I'm encouraging you to think about as first responders is to sit with somebody. And that's it. Sit with them, be with them, as they cry. Sit on the rock with them as they're struggling with whether they should stay alive or not, whether they should cut or not, how they're going to navigate life returning home in a war-torn situation. What does it look like? We have some resources for you. So the next two that we're going to look at to how to do this being present together, how to do this bearing witness and ministry of being present. And I broke it into two skill sets for you. The first one is being present, struggling together. And you can see up here on your and on your handout, sitting with them. The purpose is to create safety, to encourage, to go at their pace, and to say, this is a normal experience. Not the situation that's happened, but you're feeling suffering and pain. That's a normal response for this abnormal situation. So as I sit with them, what's happening within me? I'm afraid of them doing harm to themselves. I feel I don't have anything to do. I need something to do, right? I want to kind of be relevant. The problem stance is a prolonged silence without the teen speaking may feel like isolating and ignoring. So we need to be present, but we also have to gauge, are they experiencing my presence being with them, or are they experiencing me not being there? So being present, bearing witness might involve a few words, but that's just to acknowledge I'm with you. Because if you just sit silently and stare at them, might not feel comfortable, might feel awkward. And so finding a way to be present that's soothing for them, because then the goal is to be creating a place of safety for them to just feel. Helpful stance then is what you are doing is listening so they can express thoughts and feelings, giving signals of support. Sometimes I don't know culturally how you navigate touch in youth ministry. In the States, we've shifted of like, don't touch the youth. I think that's a cultural and legal thing. I think in other cultures, having a hand on the shoulder, having touch can be meaningful in terms of presence. You have to navigate what that is. So how do I communicate I'm with you that's in the culture, that's comfortable for both you and the teen? That's what you want to be doing, helpful stance. Reduce distraction. Being present means that there's nothing else taking your attention. I turn off my phone. I don't even want it to be buzzing or dinging with a text, because that breaks the moment of like, there's other things that I'm attending to, not you. So needing to reduce distraction, this gives them a sense of validation. Now, for me, that might be too much. I might feel disconnected. Well, what if there's a clinical emergency and someone needs to reach me? Having the phone turned off can be an anxiety-producing thing for me, and I have to find out what fits best. A problem stance is the teen feels intense pressure, feels like your intensity and the quiet and the touching and the presence is overwhelming. So we have to gauge that of like, me giving you full attention might be problematic. I find this as a gender difference in the States. Me being fully present with my daughter is face-to-face interaction. She loves to have face-to-face interaction, and there's a sense of connectedness that feels safe to her. My boys, they neurologically short-circuit if we have that much intimacy and intensity. And so we have to do it side by side. Like if we're watching a sporting event or we're just sitting together on a park bench, side by side is intense enough for them. If it's face to face, they're just like, it's a little much, Dad. And so knowing what's experienced as soothing and what's experienced as overwhelming. Do you notice that? Kind of gender-wise of side-by-side intimacy versus face-to-face intimacy. It's also a fun thing with couples, right? If men are comfortable with side-by-side intimacy and women are face-to-face, you have a weird, like, how are you going to navigate this? John Gottman is a researcher that talks about how we kind of get overwhelmed emotionally, and men get overwhelmed emotionally much quicker than women. And I think it's pretty easy to see that when Tara and I have a fight, I'm like, I think I'm overwhelmed and I need to have a timeout. And she's like, we just started. I just said, let's have the conversation. And I'm like, and I'm kind of emotionally flipped. And she's like, if you can cite Gottman and say you're emotionally triggered, you probably aren't. And I'm like, it's horrible to be married to someone smarter than you. Can I just say that? She's actually read all the same books. It's really annoying. But we have this sense of there's an intensity that is soothing to her, that same intensity is overwhelming for me. So being present, we have to appreciate the intensity. We might be comfortable. I've been trained to be very comfortable. Even though I'm a man, I'm very comfortable with emotional intensity and like nose-to-nose conversations and being able to sit and be in that emotional space. Not everybody's that way. So I need to kind of gauge, how is it soothing and how is it intrusive, and be able to have that space. Practicing gratitude. Gratitude can be helpful, but shouldn't be the primary approach. It's helpful at the end of the time. So when I'm working with a youth and they're struggling and I've been present with them and I feel like it's time to move on, whether time-wise or emotionally, I'll just like, you know what? This was really hard. I appreciate you taking the risk with me. I appreciate you letting me in, right? So that's it in terms of gratitude, of just an acknowledgement of what you just did. I saw that. Like your ability and desire to sit with me in this hard time, I saw that. I appreciate that. That's all the gratitude that you have. It's just like, oh, you did such, it's false praise. Oh, you did such a good job. We don't want to praise. We want to have gratitude for the entering in and being in that space, because that honors that time versus kind of a behavioral, like keep doing, oh, good job, keep doing that. That's not what we want to say. It's like, I see that this was hard and I'm so thankful that you took the risk. I hope that you experience me as honoring that. And then now let's go play soccer or whatever it is. Let's go back to Fusion and let's do our thing. The next one is attending, giving full focus. How many people have read Henry Nouwen, any Henry Nouwen, In the Name of Jesus book? Love In the Name of Jesus. It's about the temptations that Jesus experienced. You might notice on the top of here, I used two of the temptations to kind of highlight problematic full attending. And it's where we want to be relevant as a youth minister, or we want to be relevant as a counselor. That's a temptation that Jesus experienced in the wilderness. It's a temptation for us. I have a lot of training. I want to be relevant. I want to be important. I want to be relevant with you. It's a seduction to want to be relevant. How do I live in the space of being with you and praying that is useful, but not it being about me and me being relevant in our interaction? And the same thing about me being spectacular, right? We have a desire to be spectacular. And these challenges are challenges when we listen and when we attend. So let's look at eye contact. I've been in cultures where if you have eye contact, that's way too much intimacy and it's offensive. And so it's about avoiding eye contact, especially with people in authority. So understanding the cultural norms is really important, but eye contact does provide a sense of I'm with you. Have you ever been in that conversation where you're talking with someone and they're looking like over your shoulder or they're scanning the room? How does that feel? It's like, hey, I'm over here. Like, I'm talking to you. Are you look like, who's coming, right? You're trying to figure out what's going on, that they're not they're attending to something else. They're like, oh, no, I'm listening to you. And you're like, mm-hmm, yeah, no. And then you kind of just, the conversation is just like, I think that's all I had to say. And you move on. Because they're not attending. They're not giving you the full focus. They might be present and verbally interacting with you, but they're scanning the room to see who's better to talk to. Or they're scanning the room because they have another appointment and they need to see who, if they're coming or not. And so they're only partly with you. We don't want this when we're dealing with our youth. And it's easy because you have a room full of youth, or you have a program going and there's lots of things going on, and that youth has an immediate need and wants to talk with you. It's hard to shift to, I'm going to fully be here with you in this moment, even though there's 399 other people, it's just you and me, right? And so we have the eye contact. It feels uncomfortable. And right now it's just, I don't know that there's anybody else here. It's just you and me. Body language. And so I'm showing you I'm attending, but I'm gonna be face to face or side by side, but I'm gonna give you the body language that I'm attending. So it's the saying, like, you should tell your face you feel that way, right? We want congruence in what we're doing and what we say, our eye contact, our body. We all want it to be congruent. We all want it to be lined up and doing the same thing and giving attention. So good eye contact is culturally appropriate. Good body language is conveying warmth, safety, understanding. Good gestures are encouraging more sharing of, like, tell me more. Good facial expressions, I don't know what that is cross-culturally, so fill in the blank there. I should have left that blank and let you all just write in what culturally is a good facial expression, because I don't know. Responses. How many people know what validation is? Great, I appreciate that you know validation, right? I'm just validating you. And empathy first, this is weird for a therapist to say, but empathy is overrated, but needed. So empathy is feeling what the other is feeling and being able to communicate that. So I need to have a little bit of empathy as a clinician, like, I get you. So it seems like you're really upset and really bored at this talk. And now you're uncomfortable that we're having a conversation, right? So that's empathy. But if I feel too much of that, then I start to feel anxious. I start to feel uncomfortable about this attention, and then I can't do my job. So too much empathy, too much over-association to the other is problematic. No empathy is problematic. So you have to find your range there of how you can get a sense. And for me, it's getting a sense in my body. It's being aware of my body, that when I'm interacting with someone, I might start to have tension in my shoulders. And then I have to go, is this because I've been on a flight for 9 hours and haven't moved? Is it I played volleyball and I haven't exercised in 5 years? Or is it I'm feeling what the other is feeling? And I go through that and it's like, oh, it's what the other, so I'm like, man, it feels like things are tense right now, right? I'm talking about the tension in my body as an empathetic response to where the youth is coming. And we'll practice these things.
Thank you for listening to Josiah Venture Stories. For more information about who we are and our vision and mission, visit us at josiahventure.com and follow us on social media. If you have any questions about this episode or would like to get in touch with our guest, please email social@josiahventure.com. To help more people hear about this podcast, please leave us an honest written review or share this episode on your social media. Thank you, friends, and have a blessed day.